Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Listen, you smell something?
Put that cookie down!
Hello and welcome to the Mighty Motion Picture Rangers. I'm Shane.
I'm Chanstar.
Oh God, I almost instinctively went, we're filming it with hands.
What would have you said? What starts with F that has to do with this topic? We're fumbling about for an F.
Fumbling word. About for an F word, yeah. Which we already did like twice, I swear to God, when we were doing it. We're looking at character arcs today, looking at where characters, the journey, because we've talked about a bit about writing, a bit about plotting. We haven't looked about character stuff specifically.
Yeah, because I feel like I always bring up character stuff like in general when we talk about those things, but we haven't focused on it
as an episode. And this episode was suggested by Josh, but he's unfortunately
dead. We can't.
Killed him.
He had reached his character arc, and then it was the fall at the end of the arc.
It was a tragic.
Plummeted through the ground. Now he dead.
Apparently, along with your grandma.
Yeah. Well, they're going to be buried together.
Did you say buried together?
I sure did.
Was that deliberate?
Yes.
We have Zane to replace Josh as per usual. Hello, Zane.
You have Zane.
We have a Zane, guys.
It's a mononym like Madonna. But as always, we always ask by We stop by asking.
What do we do, Shane?
You got me up at 8 in the morning. I am tired.
Shane, what have you been watching?
I've been watching quite a lot. I watched The Favourite, which is bizarre period piece with Emma Stone, Rachel Weisz, and Olivia Colman, and it is phenomenal.
As I always say, I'm an Emma Stoner, so tell me more.
She's brilliant in it. It's a period piece shot with fisheye lenses. Like, this was like my crack cocaine. It took like a couple of seconds because I was worried at the very beginning that it was going to be like Killing of a Sacred Deer or The Lobster in that weird acting, that very stilted monotone acting, and you're just saying these things because that's part of his style. But this one's more involved. There's more acting. It just took like a couple of beats to get into it. Once it's into it, it flies and it sings. And it's like an over 2 hour movie. It went by in a snap.
Oh, wow.
It's like everything that everyone's saying about it is true. It's phenomenal performances. Its cinematography is amazing. They're like window lighting the shit out of everything. And specifically one that doesn't get enough hype is Nicholas Hoult is in it as like this pompous undersecretary and like he's minister of the opposition. Or something like that in the parliament, and he's funny as fuck. They have some really great insults they've made up and words. Everything about it is 100% true. I saw Second Act with J-Lo.
Oh yeah, how was that?
Not good.
Oh okay.
Very
surprising. Everyone.
Look, it looked a bit cheap, but I was excited
about J-Lo being back. I was like, you know what?
I like Monster
She's
and
Jenny Lock. From the block. What are you going to do?
She's still Jenny from the block. I love Monster in Law. And so I think she can usually be compelling, but this is really uncompelling in so many ways.
Also, isn't the whole plot like everyone's
she commits
life?
Fraud.
She lies on a resume.
No, because you can check. No, she doesn't just lie on a resume. It's like she literally like commits fraud. She supposedly went to Stanford and all this. Like she's literally committing like a federal offense, and then it's like, oh, but I did it for the best of intentions. It's not
money.
Yeah, money.
Yeah, I was gonna say, isn't she going for a job?
Yeah.
Man, that'd be a great plot in life, you know? You just commit fraud, and they're like, oh, why'd you lie to us? And you're like, yeah, but I wanted the money, so...
Oh, okay. So, yeah, it's not good. But, like, I wouldn't say I hated it. I just didn't really care for it. I watched Tully, which is me trying to catch up on 2018 movies.
I unfortunately listened to an interview with Jason Reitman where
and
the ending was
the
spoiled
twist.
For me. Yeah,
yeah.
Because I was
Why?
Like, oh, damn, I really wanted...
Though, to be fair, that's to me the... Have you seen Tully, Zane?
I have not.
Okay, I won't spoil it, but it's the weakest part of the movie. I reckon a lot of people really liked it, and I didn't. I thought the strongest part was the first, like, 40 minutes. I was watching it with my mom, and my mom's like, yep, this is so accurate to the entire of pregnancy. So apparently it's very hit very hard on the nail exactly what pregnancy is like. And her performance is really good. It's shot very blandly.
Am I being stereotypical when I'm saying it's written by Diablo Cody?
No, it's Diablo Cody.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because it's directed by Jason Reitman.
Yeah,
right?
So it's their third collaboration since they did.
I'm assuming.
I want to watch Young Adult. I haven't seen that one, but I've heard good things about that one. I feel like I'd like that one more than I liked Tully. But Tully was nice. It was nice and very well acted across the board. I just found it a bit boringly shot and all that kind of stuff. I watched The Rider, which is another 2018 movie. It's this mumblecore sort of movie about a horse wrangling guy who has like a horrible accident.
Yeah.
And he's trying to recover, and it's kind of a Dallas Buyers Club-esque tone. It's that mumbly handheld drama. Mm. Shot by Chloe Zhao, though, like an Asian American woman, and she's in like the heart of America. There's one shot in it that's absolutely stunning and gorgeous and beautiful. And she's used a real guy who basically like really went through exactly what's kind of happening. And then she got him to act. It's this weird light because it's a fiction story based on true events that happened to the actual people she cast in the movie. And for her to have pulled out such kind of nuanced performances out of non-actors is a really hard thing to do in general. It's hard to do with real actors. And she's pulling it off with like non-actors. So the balancing act of the movie is quite extraordinary. It's a handheld drama. It's not my thing that I gravitate towards, but this is getting a lot of like independent awards consideration and deservedly so.
Yeah.
And she's now booked to do, I believe she's doing a Marvel movie or a DC movie now, and it's deserved. Oh, wow. She knows what she's doing and she does it very well. It's just not always a thing that connects with me, but you know, it's a very beautiful movie, and that one shot in it, I would put in my top 10 shots of the year.
Cool.
Easily. I watched You Were Never Really Here, which is Lynn Ramsey's violent Joaquin Phoenix assassin movie. It's a little slow. It doesn't always connect with me, but I think it's a very interesting take on the Hitman on a Rampage movie, like the John Wicks.
Yeah.
Of the thing, because it's a much more meditative and still leaner. It's like an 80-minute movie. It's very fine. Performances are really good. There's one shot. Again, there's another shot in here. It's beautiful. It's in the water and he's throwing a body in, and it's beautifully shot, expertly crafted. I didn't love it, but I think that's more to do with me than the movie. I think it's a really great movie, and it's, again, this is landing on a lot of people's top 10 lists, deservedly so. Lynn Ramsey she knows exactly what she's doing, and she's very fucking good at it too. And then I watch Mary Poppins Returns.
How dare you?
It's terrible. And everyone's loving this movie and saying, oh, and it's flashy. There's so many things that made me mad, not in the least in which is the dialogue is like first draft level bad. There's, you know, everyone refers to everyone and they keep using each other's names in every line. So it's like, oh, Jane, you can't do this. But Michael, da da da. Well, I didn't do this, Jane. Oh, Michael, da da. And like the whole time, and a gratingly obvious. And I mean, there's an interesting thing to say. See, watching Ben Whishaw, who's a very accomplished actor, working his ass off to sell any, because he has some of the cheapest lines in the movie, and he's working his ass off to sell it to you. It's not working, but that's not to do with him. That's to do with the lines. None of the musical numbers feel earned. They're all forgettable. And he's the one thing that I found the most egregious is that it's shot poorly. There is like, it's like the camera person never rehearsed with the blocking, and they're shooting it for the first time, and there's these all these little like readjustments. The camera's doing these little like it like, oh, they missed a bit of the headroom, so they adjust up, or they adjust to the left, or they adjust to the right, and it looked really first take rehearsal.
Weird.
Kind, yeah. And
you've sold me. I want to see it now.
Rob Marshall he's not known for being a visual stylist in a way like Scott said. He doesn't design shots. He usually shoots it from about 12 different angles, cuts it together after the fact. And it worked in Into the Woods because everything in Into the Woods is on Steadicams. I think where it was different in this is that everything was on cranes and or dollies in this.
Yeah.
And that doesn't work with that style. If you've got a crane or a dolly, it needs to move to a set place, because then otherwise you're getting these little adjustments that look like mistakes. And
Because they are mistakes.
They are mistakes. And it was overshot and overcut. And you have these, you have Lin-Manuel Miranda and a horde of these lamplighters doing these incredible acrobatic feats. And you're shooting so much of it in close-ups and cuts. And the whole point of having dancers who can fucking do it is you cut to a wide and you watch them do it. That's what they did in Mary Poppins, what they did in Singing in the Rain. That's when you've got a cast that can do that. And Lin-Manuel Miranda can dance with the best of them. And I was like, you're doing a disservice to this, not just the narrative, but the style. It doesn't fit the old one. They rarely throw back to the old one. Mm. There's a lot of stunt casting cameos. There's a Meryl Streep role that exists.
Oh, wow.
They go to her to get this bowl fixed. The bowl never comes back into the story ever again for the entire movie. It's halfway through. There's this whole musical number.
Is Dick Van Dyke still alive?
Yes, he's in the movie.
Okay, cool. Well, that's all right. Does he have a terrible accent?
No.
Oh, what?
No. but Lin-Manuel Miranda, they've dubbed every single one of his lines, and I swear they drew on his stubble at some points. Like, the stubble was there were some points where it was real, and there were some points where his stubble was makeup. It looked like makeup to me, and I was really bothered by it, and every single line of his is ADR'd. Emily Blunt is fine. She's a bit too emotional. Mary Poppins is meant to be. The whole point is that Mary Poppins is so stoic amongst the most bizarre fantastical shit going on around her, and she kind of revels in the fantastical shit a bit too much for liking. Yeah. Maybe that's her trying to do an interpretation of it. But I just, there was so much about this movie that made me angry, and I'm completely unsatisfied by the end. You know, in the original Mary Poppins, she fixes this and that and the other and the kids, and everywhere they go fixes a different problem with them. They just go to places and have funny musical numbers in weird and wacky places. And there's no connection to the songs. There's no connection to where they're going, what they're learning. The only real lesson is the dad learns to maybe be a little less testy, but his kids come in and fucking nearly get him fired. Of course you're going to be pissed. It's so understandable that you're just like, oh, it's
you
not.
You sound so old, Shane. Are kids going to like it?
I reckon they'll find it flashy. They'll like pretty much anything that looks
but
flashy.
But are kids going to like it?
Yeah, but they're not going to remember it. They're not going to remember the way we remembered Mary Poppins.
I'm not saying what you're saying is not valid. I'm just saying, is this going to be one of these things that is specifically made for kids because they don't have this nostalgia for the previous Mary Poppins and they don't have the level of taste that you're applying to it? Is it something,
no,
a simple,
sure,
enjoyable pleasure for child?
Every child who watches it
but
is going to be like,
can
why
be
do
you like
keep
that,
moving
but
the
you
camera
want, if
on?
You want, if you want the children to watch it again in 10 years' time, 12 years' time, that's not going to happen with this.
Shane.
And
the
this
world's
movie
not
cost, this movie
in
cost
10 100 years time.
I was looking this up. This movie cost $130 million. It cost the cost of making La La Land three times and then enough budget to do fucking Get Out like three more times on top of that. Or you could do
why
Into
would
the Woods.
Do that?
You could do Into the Woods twice.
Why would people
and La
have
La
money
La
and be like, look, I know we've shot the movie. Let's do it two more times because we have the money.
What do you mean?
This is like an insane world you were suggesting, Shane.
But you could do Into the Woods twice and then La La Land on top of that. Anyway, that's my ranting about Mary Poppins Returns. What have you been watching, Chanstar?
Well, what have I been watching? So, you know how Disney took over Stan and now what's it called? That show that I really was in the middle of watching and then they just took it off. The Murder Mysteries one.
Miss Fisher.
Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries. So I haven't been watching Miss
you
Fisher's.
You haven't been watching.
No,
this
I
is
can't.
Cool. What have you been watching?
Well, instead I watched Bolt, which is good. You know, I don't know why, because so I was looking at IMDb and Chloe Grace Moretz played the main girl when she was a kid. And then she's still a kid, but now she's played by Miley Cyrus.
Correct.
Why the hell? Turns out Chloe Grace Moretz recorded the whole movie and then they dubbed her. But why? Miley Cyrus has a terrible voice. Like, she sounds like she's smoking while she's talking. Every time her voice goes a little bit high, it cuts off because she's constantly got a cold or something. And I'm like, why would you do that? Chloe Grace Moretz is a much better actress. She might not have the name of Miley Cyrus, but who cares?
It's Disney, you don't need names.
Exactly. John Travolta was good. You know, I liked him. And who was the one playing the cat?
Is he the voice of Bolt?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can't remember who plays the cat, but she was really good as well. It was a good movie. It didn't win Disney vs. Disney for a reason, but it was a really fun movie and I enjoyed it. I cried at the end, but I cry in everything. So, you know, I watched Coco finally.
Hooray!
I really loved it. It was great.
You mean you watched The Book of Life?
Look, no, they are nothing alike.
Yes, they are.
Okay, other than the fact that they are both based on Day of the Dead and they both have guitars in it.
Magical guitars, and it's about a boy growing up, becoming a man.
Yeah, that's fucking every... That's like saying no, that...
Coco's not about him becoming a man. It's about him reconciling the past of his family with the future of his family.
And being able to play
guitar. It's not a coming of age story.
No, definitely not.
Fine.
That's like saying that every single Christmas movie that has Santa in it is the same. You're comparing Fred Claus to the Santa Claus, which are not comparable because Fred Claus is a great movie.
Terrible.
We should all watch it. I really loved it. But that being said, I do want to go back and watch The Book of Life again because I really loved Coco. I think...
I saw the twist coming in Coco a mile away.
That's my one complaint is at the very start, I was like, oh, he's going to be his granddad. And then as soon as he met the other guy in the world of the dead, I was like, he's his granddad. Got it. Okay, move on. And then, oh my God, look, he was a bad guy.
But again, like that's a twist for kids. Like that was it. It doesn't really require the twist.
When I was a kid, my standards were higher than that.
Yeah, he was watching Mary Poppins going, you know what?
I'm not moving the camera correction.
A little bit. I think the one thing that I would... Because I think I prefer Book of Life's kind of like non-linear storytelling. Like it's
presented as a fable.
Yeah, exactly. Which I preferred. But Coco, I preferred the fact that the human art style was much more different than the
wooden dead... Puppet.
Sorry?
Wooden puppet. I thought you meant in Book of Life, everyone's wooden puppet.
I love the wooden puppet art style, but the fact that the wooden puppet art style is the same between the humans and the dead in Book of Life, whereas in this one, the humans look very different to the skeletons, which is, I enjoy that. Otherwise, I've probably watched other things. I don't know. Those were the two main things that I watch Disney stuff. Oh, no. You know what? I watched Lethal Weapon mainly because...
Christmas,
yeah. And I think... Lethal Weapon is definitely more of a Christmas film than Die Hard. I think it uses the themes of Christmas much better because Die Hard, it literally was tacked on.
It's just set at Christmas.
Yeah, because Lethal Weapon was set at Christmas. And Joel Silver was like, hey, let's do Christmas. And I love Die Hard, but no, I really do still love Lethal Weapon 1. And I haven't watched 2 yet, but I probably will soon.
You've never watched 2?
No, I've seen 2 before.
Oh, okay.
I love 2. I
haven't seen either of them.
Why not? What's your excuse?
I own Lethal Weapon on Blu-ray. I just haven't gotten around to it. There's only so many hours in the day, Chance.
You have 2, 3, and 4?
Mm-mm.
Well,
they're on Netflix, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
Zane, what have you been watching?
Bad Stuff.
Ooh, man, you're a man after my own heart. Tell me more.
I watched the Netflix original movie, Dumplin'.
Why would you do that?
Yes.
I did it because some people who like movies like that said, it's not a bad movie. It's a bad movie.
I saw like 2 seconds of it because my mom was watching it. I'm like, nah.
There's nothing really to say about it. Like, it's exactly what you imagine it to be. There's no interesting...
I'm fat and nobody likes me. Oh, I'm going to teach them that being looking different is not good, not bad.
Yes.
Dolly Parton.
With more of mother-daughter stuff thrown in there. Yeah. And to be fair, the mother isn't terrible. Like, she's not is not a terrible person. She's not like the stereotypical villain, but still, it's not a compelling movie.
No,
I wouldn't watch it. And then I tried to watch some of the first season of Sick Note.
Okay.
Everyone's been raving about this. It's not good.
I do not like it at
all. I've gotten through the first 2 episodes, maybe 3 episodes.
I feel like it's a British company trying to do an American comedy.
Yeah, I was going to say it does not feel British.
No.
Which is concerning. I honestly thought it may have been an American company trying to do British.
Yeah. I just found the exposition like really clunky. The characters like had like 3 changes of heart in the first episode.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm like, I don't care. Goodbye.
Yeah, when I watched the trailer was the first episode.
Yeah.
Because I was like, okay, cool. So he finds out. When I was watching the trailer, I'm like, oh man, it's a bummer that we find out that he doesn't have cancer in the trailer because that'd be like a cool twist. It's all in the first episode.
All in the first episode.
He has cancer. He doesn't have cancer. Now he has to pretend like he has cancer at the end.
Yeah. It's Rupert Grint, pretty unimpressive in it.
Yeah.
And same with everyone else. Like,
I want to see where Nick Frost's character goes, because the Nick Frost character is, I want to say the bumbling fool, but, and like the him and his wife's relationship, I want to see if there's actual any payoff to any of this.
I mean, yes, but I'm not going to watch the whole season for that. I mean,
I am.
Nick Frost was interesting, but like, the scripting, he'd play like three scenes the exact same way. And I'm like, okay, is this, you're just a loser? That, all right, good. I guess there's no one to like in that show.
That is true.
Yeah. So.
Oh, no, there's the guy on the Xbox, the friend.
Do not like.
Oh, really? Yeah. I'm like, he hasn't done anything bad yet, has he?
He's trash.
He's literally telling him to lie to his girlfriend?
Okay, good point. Yeah.
Yeah. I think do not recommend from Zane.
Nah, fair enough.
I wanted to like it because I like Rupert Grint. I like the indie movies that he's done.
Mm. I love Thunderpants.
Sure.
That's a terrible movie.
You can have your opinion.
I walked out of that one when I was a child.
No, actually, no. That's one of the first movies I remember hating. Which is hard to do when you're 10.
And yeah, so that's what I've been watching. Disappointing things.
Nice. Well.
Right. Well, character arc. So what is an arc and why do characters need them?
Story.
Yeah.
I mean, that's change is what stories are about.
Yeah.
Or lack of change.
Going from point A to point B.
It's a path is what it is. It's a path because a bunch of stuff can happen and that's plot. Mm. But plot without a direction is
Mary Poppins a return? Hey, I haven't even seen.
I mean,
movie.
There's a plot and there's a deadline, but it's so arbitrary.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's not even like because what it is he's about to lose the house because he took out a loan and the bank wants to take it back, and he's got 5 days to find that he has shares in the bank that'll let them keep the loan.
Oh God, I'm already so bored.
And but I was like, oh, what if the share certificate is that he owns like a huge chunk of the bank, and so the evil bank person. Spoiler alert, played by Colin Firth, is wanting the shares so that he can own the bank.
I
but
like
no,
the
he
spoiler
just.
Spoiler alert is the fact that he's played by Colin Firth.
Yeah, but there's like there are cameos up the wazoo in this movie. Meryl Streep is in it for no fucking reason. But I thought it would be like he wants it because it's shares in the bank and so it's going to get him to own the bank. No, he just wants it because he likes taking houses off people.
Sounds
there's
like
no
Firth.
Specific reason that this specific house. Is part of his list. It just is. It's so uncompelling.
Motivation is a key thing.
Motivation. It gives it forward propulsion, an emotional propulsion rather than a narrative propulsion. So it's not
motivation is one of the things that can like define an arc. So your situation might not change, but your motivation for moving forward can.
That's one of the things I always write as my, that's like my turning point. I'm like, no, he's still trying to go for the same thing, but the reason they're going for it, which I think is more compelling than, oh, he's changed his mind. He's going to go for this thing instead.
And a lot of thing is, it's people who want something for the wrong reasons and they need to either not want that thing and figure out they need something else. Or, you know, it's what they want versus what they need is a lot of the thing they teach you in film school. But it's usually the glue between the plot and the theme is what a character is. It sticks the two things together because you can have a movie about courage being, you know, what you need. And then it's a story about dropping jewelry into a volcano and the character arc of, you know, the reluctance.
What movie could you be speaking of?
So characters need them because static characters are boring.
Yeah. Actually,
Garden State.
Literally,
I keep bringing this up because it's such a bad movie.
Literally what you just said, Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, Frodo doesn't have a character arc and he's meant to be the main character.
But
he does in 2 and 3.
We can talk about that a little bit more.
Okay.
Because like without an arc, the story is without a purpose. Stuff just happens and then the credits roll. So films, and there's a part of the film audience, the audience story relationship. Films are made to show us how to act in our own lives. There's a cathartic thing. And if nothing changes, we don't feel like we've gone and done anything when we watch it. So there's sort of two main like arcs where stuff happens. There's a positive arc and a negative arc. There's also something called a flat arc, which we'll talk about before. There's a really great video on characters without arcs that I'll put a link to in the show notes.
Is that the Paddington one?
Yes,
how Paddington 2 was the best Superman movie we'll ever have.
No, that's not a Patrick Willems one, although Patrick Willems references it. It's a Just Right episode, but he references Paddington 2 as an example. But we'll get that in a sec. Tick. But a positive arc is when they change for the better, or a negative arc is a tragedy.
Yeah.
They change for the worse. Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
It's sort of a good example. So how do arcs work in TV versus how do they work in movies? I think this is a very interesting
crossover. Well, generally they're more stretched out in TV. Because like with TV, you need an arc for an episode, but you need an arc for a season. Same thing with story. So like if your character is going through a change, and I'm sure you guys will be able to bring up Breaking Bad because I haven't seen it. The changes are incremental episodically, but the change seasonal is big.
But you can also have in TV, they can be very cyclical, especially in older sitcoms.
Oh, yes.
Arcs really change, or if they do, they reset by the end of it.
Yeah.
So Will and Grace, I like Will and Grace, but Grace learns that she needs to treat Will a bit better, and then the very next episode, she's a shit to him. She's an utter shitty friend. She's really terrible for him. On serialized TV, you're right, it's usually season-long arcs. They don't, and it's doled out episode by episode, and some episodes something won't change. Some shows that burn through a lot of story, aka like Arrow season one, they have like whole arcs across individual episodes. So like in one episode of Arrow, he realizes that he should stop killing people because he's literally just like straight up slaughtering villains for like the first half of the season. And he's awesome. Like, oh, I need to kind of not do that anymore if I'm trying to be some kind of moral compass for the city.
I thought you were going to say, I better stop killing people or I won't have a second season.
No, they're just killing random crime lords who are like slumming it up in the city. But he literally learns, oh, I need to be a bit more of a human being. And that's like an arc that happens over maybe two episodes.
Oh, wow.
In the full season, because he goes on this giant journey. I don't know about later because I quit watching after season two. On smart TV shows, they do both. They have incremental and season-long arcs. Something like The Good Fight is such a great, because the characters are moving through every episode, and yet there's a season-long arc that you kind of don't realize until the end. You're like, oh, that's what they were going for.
Especially Daredevil season one and Jessica Jones season one really worked that.
Yeah.
The best TV usually does. Whereas in movies, there's very much a finality to it as well.
Yeah.
TV is sort of like putting a character through a lot. It's very literary. It's putting it through a lot of different stuff. Whereas a movie has a finality, it's usually a lot more simple.
And generally, if they do a sequel to it, either they do the stupid thing where the character arc is reset and none of the first movie mattered, or they change in a new, better way, which I'm trying to Lethal
Weapon. Incredibles, Incredibles 2.
Yes.
Ah, there we go. That's perfect.
National Treasure 1 and National Treasure 2.
Get out of my house.
No, but you are right there.
Because season one was, I mean, he doesn't, I was trying to read up on this thing and they were like, this character doesn't have an arc. I'm like, you didn't watch the movie, because they brought up like in National Treasure, and I'm like, I guess you can see he's a guy who believes in the treasure. He wants to get the treasure. He gets the treasure.
Yeah.
So he doesn't really change in National, but he does. There's sort of like this, he more so changes the people around him, I reckon. So maybe it is a flat
so
arc.
So he's like Paddington. So what you're saying, but number National two is Treasure about, equals as good as Paddington 2.
But number two,
it
develops on the pigheadedness that he gets from winning in season it's not season one. Ooh, it's not a TV show. In the first movie to the second movie, and his pigheadedness is part of the arc. Him versus Diane Kruger, they're broken up now. They got married at the end of the first, it's alluded they get married, and then they skip to them already split.
That I love that about the second one, is the fact that The events of the first one have affected them for the worst, even though it ended on such a high note.
And it usually has an end position in a movie. Everything leads there.
Yeah.
Whereas in TV, they often haven't even written the end of the show.
They leave it open-ended because you always need to be able to continue
because the idea
if
is
you get picked up for another season.
Yeah, the idea is the show needs to be able to go on for an infinite number of episodes, which creates good and bad things about it.
Which is why I think Breaking Bad was such a success, because they had this arc planned out over
from the get-go.
this number of episodes.
And they did the same thing in The Good Wife. Her arc was plotted out. It's much longer. It took a lot. It was a bit more of a circuitous route, but she had sort of a very compelling arc. For movies, it's always a lot more clear what the arc is as well. And yeah, because they haven't written it in TV often.
Yeah, TV is like, oh, where are we? Oh, and we're there.
Yeah, well, so there's a lot of sudden twists in TV as opposed to movies don't often have that.
Yeah, well, I think you're tied to that because of the episodic nature.
Yeah.
Because you'll have them making some progress towards the end goal of their arc, but having a setback in the next episode. And
Yeah. I feel like watching a movie where they did that, where like, oh, it's a random change at sudden points, would just feel weird.
Well, it does. I'm trying to think. There's an example. I'm trying to think of it recently.
Because I know like a lot of the time, like the Futurama movies or Red Dwarf Season 9, because they were originally meant to be a movie thing and then they split it up into an episodic thing and it just doesn't work episodically.
Mm. So bad arcs versus good arcs. And to clarify what I mean, that it is, but it's like, what's like a compelling or interesting or unique arc versus a cliche arc?
sorry, I just thought
a villain Michael learning Bay to love again, like it's a Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
It's usually like the cliche kind of like the unexpected is necessary for a compelling arc. To me, it's what makes Michael kind of compelling in The Good Place.
Yeah.
Is that he's a demon and his whole goal was he had a tangible, almost endearing goal as a demonic force to torture the people. Cause he was like, he really was in, he had an ambition for what he wanted to do. He wanted to change the system and then he's kind of fucked up, but then his role kind of changed. I think he's one of the more compelling characters on television.
Yeah.
But you can also have a very expected arc if the getting there. So rom-coms, the arc is pretty set from the beginning.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Which might be why I don't like rom-coms. I don't like rom-coms.
I thought you were going to say noir coms, and I'm like, a noir comedy.
A noir rom-com.
He falls for the femme fatale. That'd be a weird genre.
Like, it's a noir for the first half, and then the second half is him just trying to get the femme fatale. Going, no, I loved you all along.
A noir rom-com, I that is the pitch for a Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego movie, right?
No, see, my version of that has the kids trying to hunt down like their missing parents and Carmen
Sandiego. There are no kids in this movie.
No.
This is not a kids movie.
She's not wearing a red jacket. She's wearing red lingerie.
And a giant red hat.
Because that's the hot part.
Yeah.
Oh.
A great arc as well should feel completely inevitable. You should be like, oh, of course that's where it was going the whole time, but you just couldn't put the pieces together because it was being presented to you. That's the hardest thing, because you can either have something ultra surprising and out of nowhere, a la Now You See Me, but it doesn't work because they deliberately withheld the ability to predict that for you, which that to me makes... although some people love Now You See Me. One.
People are wrong.
They're very
people are trash.
Wrong.
People are wrong.
And bad arcs make you relinquish emotional investment in how it all turns out. I think that's the biggest problem, is that it's not... that's why those movies where there's a lot of like action and plot and then there's no character arc, you just tune out. Because it could be the most... exciting, spectacular thing in the world and you don't give two fucks about it.
Now, I haven't seen 4 and 5, but Michael Bay's Transformer movies.
Yeah.
Because... they have the littlest arc possible, I think.
One is the best. Although apparently Bumblebee is amazing.
Oh, yeah. Well, he made by the person who did fucking Kubo and the Two Strings. What were you expecting?
Oh, really? And do you know who wrote it? Kelly Freeman Craig, who did Edge of 17.
Yeah, well, yeah, then of course.
So it's like a coming-of-age story with Hailee Steinfeld. I'm like, okay, I kind of really want to see Bumblebee now.
I've wanted to see it for ages, ever since I found out the director. But they, someone posted on Reddit or whatever the other day how it's just a horse movie, but with a robot.
Yeah, horse movie with a robot.
Where the girl finds the horse robot. And then, the horse robot's a little thing, so she's got to take it in. She's got to treat the horse robot right.
I wonder if that's why you're not big on coming of age movies. And is that a part of the reason why?
Is it because you're an ageless freak?
I think it's because I'm old. I don't buy into coming of age movies anymore.
But everyone comes of age. People come of age. Like, that happens in real life. But like, because it's such a well-trodden arc.
More so than most, everyone's going to come of age. Like, even people who suffer from arrested development, they come of age and then they stop developing. Like, it's very rare that you find someone who is entirely a toddler their entire life.
Unless it's an old Adam McKay movie, like Step Brothers.
Or Trump.
This is true. Hey, politics. Can having no arc work?
Well, yeah. So you said we were going to come back to it.
We were. It's called a flat arc. It's the actual thing. But refusing to change can also be an arc.
Yeah.
And that's the downward arc. So they sink further into the awfulness that they are
because, that's the negative side of it. It's like there could be a positive force here, but because they're rejecting it, they go down and get stabbed in the back.
It's very hard to sell those as well because people think, oh, it's sad, therefore it makes it more unique because we're so sick of so that's why I get really angry at people who rebel against happy endings for no other reason than they want to rebel against happy endings. Mm. It should be justified. It shouldn't only be justified because you don't like.
Yeah, I think there's also a lot of story to be mined by one character having no arc and the rest of the characters kind of fighting around that.
Yeah. So that's kind of like the basis of a flat arc is what happens is the most important thing is the supporting characters.
Yeah.
They change.
Yeah.
So we talked about Paddington. Mm. Paddington, in Paddington 1, yes, but Paddington 2 more so because you see it in the prison, you see it in all the people around him. He just wants to get a birthday present for his Aunt Lucy. That's like the plot of that movie.
I cried at the end.
I cried. Happy birthday, Aunt Lucy is like, oh, like if you ever meet Ben Whishaw, I'm just going to say, can you say happy birthday, Aunt Lucy to me, please?
He will run. No, it's fair enough. I met Joe Bauer the other day and I was just like, oh, hey, you know, I'm just a big fan. He was alone as well, so he couldn't even like.
Oh, no. The Shawshank Redemption is an example of this. Yes, Andy doesn't change, but he changes Red. He changes the prison. He changes everyone. He even changes the villain, which is such a great, compelling part of that movie. Sister Act 2 versus Sister Act 1. What's really interesting is Sister Act 1 is a positive arc.
Yep.
Sister Act 2 is a flat arc. She's changed. And this is what makes Sister Act 2 one of the best sequels because the way it's designed is not repeating. She doesn't have to become even less trashy or whatever. Like the plot is that she's changed for better. Now she has to take that change and impart it to other people who don't have
so
the privilege.
So the nuns help her. Now she has to help
the kids.
The kids who are her.
That's what makes it such a great sequel, I reckon. I think that's what's really compelling. Mary Poppins 1.
Mm.
Mary Poppins doesn't change.
Nope.
She changes everyone around her.
Same with Nanny McPhee, right? Also known
Nanny McPhee's a little more emotionally involved. Nanny McPhee physically changes.
You can't say a character's arc is their physical changes.
Yes, it is. That is how you represent it. That is how you represent the story. So that's how
her physical changes are representing the changes around her, though. They're not representing her changes.
No, this is true. This is true. Because she's quote unquote ugly. There's an interesting video essay, which I'll put in the show notes as well, that Ghostbusters is a really interesting case for there being no arc and no theme to it. And there's a couple things you can maybe read into it, but it's a movie without a theme almost because there's nothing learned or achieved by it. And yet it's still compelling. And no one really knows how it worked. It just did. And when they tried to repeat it, you get Ghostbusters 2, which got mixed reviews.
Yeah.
And Ghostbusters, the reboot, is got an arc. It's got an actual arc. So I think maybe that might be anyone who's being honest about why they didn't like it. You know,
I think another example of kind of a bad example of flat arcs is Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
Yep.
Well, because that's 100%. Just a bad movie.
Well,
the kid doesn't do anything.
I think it's because all of the characters are just fighting for the status quo.
Yeah.
Like they don't want anything to change, including where they live, what they do, like literally day to day, exactly the same. So none of them, and at the end, they don't realize that they haven't decided that they want things to change now. They want to live a better life. They literally just want to go back. So the whole array of characters don't learn anything. It's just plot happening.
Yeah. And I think, that movie was, and even the book wasn't that great. Like it's the problem stems from the source material as much as the movie. I think experimental films are ones where obviously there's no narrative to speak of a lot of the time. Ferris Bueller doesn't have an arc.
Yeah. Well, that's because it's not really Ferris's story. It's Tall Guy McFace name.
And Ferris is an invented. Are you buying that?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it's not his story. It's Cameron's story. It's Cameron's story.
Ferris is Hobbes to Cameron's Calvin.
Something like Crimson Peak is really interesting because Edith goes on an arc, but it's also not Edith's story.
Yeah.
It's Lucille's story as told by Edith, but Edith even has a change throughout the story and Tom, like all those characters. I think that movie is so much more, I'm watching it at the moment with the commentary track. I think that movie is so much more intricate than anyone gives it credit for, narratively speaking, not just visually.
Mm-hmm.
The article that I read about characters who don't change, and it listed Raiders of the Lost Ark, which no, fucking Indy changes. He starts at the beginning saying, I don't believe in all that stuff. And at the end of the movie, and you can usually tell it, but you see what they do at the end. They make a choice near the beginning of the movie and make a choice near the end of the movie. And those two sort of tell you what the arc is. Indy at the beginning, he's like, I don't believe in God and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I'm a scientist. I'm an archaeologist. And at the end of the thing, he tells Marion, he says, close your eyes.
Yeah.
He believes. He goes from an unbeliever to a believer. And yet they listed Kill Bill as well. And I'm like, that's a huge change.
Yeah, that's a huge arc.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest sort of, it's an operatic arc, if anything. Mm. It's not exactly subtle. So that's all I've got. Have we got anything other notes? Other Ari
character? Well, how do you like to write character arc, Shane?
Good question. I usually start by, I build it into the opening and the closing scene.
Yeah.
I learned that trick off Blake Snyder's Save the Cat. He says you start with an opening image and a closing image, and that in that is encapsulated the theme, and then the film is an exploration of that idea. And I'm not necessarily always on the nose about it.
Yeah. I definitely
something am. Like Red Curtain Hell, now available on Vimeo on demand.
Use that's, picture. Oh fuck!
That's Sorry. Vimeo.com/on-demand/Red Curtain Hell.
Use picture ranges as your coupon code for 20% off your rental or purchase.
I think that's all tragic arcs, pretty much.
Yeah,
everyone fucks up. And I didn't exactly plot it that way. It just kind of fell that way. I mean, we knew it was going to be, because you're basing it off Shakespeare anyway. So yeah. It's going to run in those kind of realms. I'm trying to think, little arcs. Yeah, no, little arcs. It's usually built into the opening and the closing image. I come at it more from a directing standpoint than I do a writing standpoint. I'm not like,
oh, really?
Intellectualizing the theme. I'm realizing this now as I'm saying it. I always come at it visually, which I hope is a better way of going about it.
Yeah.
I know I've done that with the horror that I'm writing at the moment. Literally the opening and the closing images are like hard burned into the theme and they're really specific.
I definitely write it in, obviously. And usually
because a lot of the time I'm focused on surface level things, and then it's only as I'm designing things visually or that where the quote unquote theme comes out. I should make a movie about the destructive power of capitalism, and then I go and figure out characters and plot that it's associated with that.
Generally my themes are all personal, and they're like always like it was really funny going
what do you see
film
as
school.
The theme for Pizza Deliverance?
Pizza Deliverance is the theme is,
and what
pizza.
Are the arcs?
Well, the arcs I think are obvious because it's a buddy comedy, which is why I generally like writing two characters who are opposing and bringing them together. L Plates was the same, but it was specifically they don't work out together. But obviously, you know, L Plates.
Oh my God, it's the sister film to L Plates.
With L Plates, it starts with her all nervous, standing out there by herself, and at the end she's standing by herself strong, having killed her roommate, obviously. With Pizza Deliverance, it was meant to be them walking far apart from each other to the front door.
They do that though. That is there.
But it's not the opening.
But it's an overture. See, like yeah, Red Curtain Hell starts on a dead stage and ends on a dead stage. There's 22 minutes of exposition set up before. Necessarily the opening image of Red Curtain Hell is a disabled parking spot.
True.
And that says a lot about who you are.
I know, right?
It sets the theme. It sets the idea of what this movie is about. It's an able-bodied gentleman taking up a disabled parking spot because he's a selfish prick.
Yeah.
That tells you what the movie is about, but most people don't grab onto it. I don't think the opening image has to be the very first image.
Yeah.
But there has to be an arc at some point, visually speaking, in the movie to represent it.
Because with Pizza Deliverance, it starts with the two walking far apart to the front door, and by the end, they're arm in arm walking back to the car.
That's really cool.
The buddy comedy I'm writing now.
And they're arguing and then they're happy bantering. Exactly, they're still bantering both versions, but it's a different kind of banter.
Exactly. That's kinda cool. With the one I'm writing now, because I know the character arcs I want.
Oh, wait, what are you writing now?
The buddy comedy musical.
No, you haven't told me about this.
So it's a buddy cop musical, mainly because I want to do an action comedy musical, combine it all into all the things I love.
Good luck. They are so fucking hard.
The only thing that I've really worked out that I musical wise is that I want a good cop, bad cop, interrogation scene that's a tango, and they reprise that song.
Are you going to do like that musical thing like in Rent, where you like go into an actual tango thing, like you basically like transition onto like a dance floor?
No, I won't do that.
Please do that. Maybe.
Who knows? Depends on how the writing goes.
Get a hall, like hire a community hall, and then just like spotlights on the ground, and then stop down like a motherfucker.
This is going to be a feature I'm writing, so I won't be shooting this anytime soon. I'm just writing it for now. But yeah, the idea, because it's a buddy comedy, it's a buddy cop thing. So you've got this girl who's a bad cop, who by bad cop, she's bad at a job.
Yeah.
And then you've got this detective, this private detective, who's like a really by the books, straight edge sort of guy. And by the end, they both kind of like
in the middle.
Her whole story, her whole arc is the arc I keep on doing, which is finding confidence in herself. Because and that's why I want the tango for the good cop, bad cop. And that comes as a reprise at the end, where he's telling her that she is a good cop because she cares about what she's doing. And that's where he's all old and jaded, so he doesn't give a shit anymore. But with her actually caring about it, it's kind of brought him back. They boost each other up. Yay.
That's cool. So, yeah, I want to see this.
The character arc is generally the first thing I figure out. I'm like, this is where I want my characters to be.
It's the through line in which you can hang plot on.
And that's what I'm doing now. I'm like, all right, here I can hang my plot.
Yeah, and it also it invigorates what you can go, oh, well, I want a scene that does this. Oh, well, how do I relate it to the character arc? Character arc is usually what I'm stringing on.
It's
connected to the theme, but I'm not intellectualizing it in a philosophical standpoint. Yeah. I think that's where a lot of movies go wrong is when it's philosophized. Is that the word I'm looking for? Philosophized first before it's a literal thing.
Yeah, whereas I always start as a literal thing and then the philosophy comes afterwards.
Yeah.
It's my garnish, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So that's all we've got for character arcs. Oh, Zane, how do you write character arcs?
I'm theater. You're a theater man.
I'm not a writer.
You don't intend to write.
You're an improv artist, so how do you character arc Cluedo interactive?
Oh, no, that's actually a very interesting thing is...
Good.
You make a choice, you commit to it, and then you progress the story. You resist the urge to stay and develop this funny thing that you've just come up with. You have to add something new to it. So when you're doing improv, you always have to give the other person a name, have a relationship with them, and then progress that relationship. So if you're husband and wife, are you about to get a divorce?
So it's not just going, oh, we've got a circle of people and oh, now
and the
I've
better
got
kind of improv
legs.
Is not where you're just like pulling a gun out on someone randomly. It's something that's you got to try and be a little more bouncing off what the other
performers. If you're a husband, wife, grocery shopping and you've picked up some apples, you need to do something with those apples. So either the wife starts berating the husband and he's really sad about it. And then at the end of the scene, you'll probably make him stand up to her, and then that's the scene with jokes added.
That's what gives an improv a more complete feeling. Rather than
improv without emotion and character is either just jokes, which is sketch comedy, or it is bad.
The fine line,
and not even funny.
Well, that's what worked really well in Pizza was I from the very start. As a director, I made sure my two actors knew their character arcs. And if they know their character arcs, they know their motivations, they know at what points what things changes, then I'm happy for them to improvise through a scene because they know where that scene is going.
I found out on Lord of the Rings that Peter Jackson just left that job up to Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens. So if the actors had questions, they would just phone them. I mean, he'd come in with notes and stuff, but because he was manning like 7 units at a time at any one time, he left a lot of the actors to call Fran Walsh or Philippa Boyens, especially Philippa Boyens, because Fran Walsh was doing a lot of directing as well. Philippa Boyens, who was the Tolkien expert of the three of them as well, ask about the development of the character and sort of stuff like that. So that's a good place to end on a character arc topic. I think it's a really interesting topic. Thank you, Josh, for that topic.
Yeah, thanks, Josh.
Yeah, Josh.
I thought we'd do top five character arcs, movies or TV.
Yeah.
I'll go first because I'm probably going to be – I probably have the most. Honorable mentions.
You generally do.
Honorable mentions, Alicia Florrick and The Good Wife. And that's a really well fleshed out arc that was planned from the beginning, even though it takes a time because it's a 22 episode show. And they do it with a closing and an opening image. Yeah. And I didn't quite pick up on that the first time I saw the ending. And then when I picked up, I'm like, oh shit, that's really intricate. Rick from Casablanca is a classic one. I stick my neck out for nobody. And then he sticks his neck out. I mean, that's really classic screenwriting as well in the best kind of way. Giselle from Enchanted. Mm-hmm. Has a and it should be a bad, you know, it's
are
the,
these honorable mentions?
These are honorable mentions.
Okay, cool.
Ida from Ida, which is that Polish film I mentioned a little while back. She's basically, it's a Catholic nun who finds out she was Jewish and hidden away because of the Nazis. And so she tries to maybe let go of being a Catholic nun, and then she kind of circles back on it. It's elliptical in a really compelling way. A lot of elliptical character arcs I'm like, oh, you just gave up so that you could reset at the beginning. It worked in Inside Llewyn Davis as an elliptical arc.
Yes, yeah.
Which is phenomenal. Oh, you've seen Inside Llewyn Davis?
I probably never mentioned it.
Good. But Ida is a really compelling, beautiful one, and it's done in like 80 minutes as well.
See, that when it comes to storytelling, I think you have a lot of, possibilities with religion.
Yeah.
But almost all
as I'm finding out writing my horror.
Yeah. Like you could do those elliptical arcs and have it really poignant, really nice. Or you can do that Nicolas Cage, what's it called?
Knowing.
Left Behind.
Oh, Left Behind. I thought you were talking about Knowing, which that's a terrible movie too.
Left Behind.
But anyway, I've got Korra from The Legend of Korra. She has a really great arc, and I find her arc more compelling than Aang in The Last Airbender, even though I love The Last Airbender.
Hers is definitely more personal than Aang's.
Yeah. Aang's is very based on the larger story, whereas hers is quite... And it's funny because the bigger the outside plot goes, the more internalized her arc becomes, which I find really, really well good in the writing. Cobb from Inception is one of my favorite get over grief plots, even more so than Up. And I love Up, but I think Inception is such a great representation of that and thoughts and ideas and emotions. And then you can pick literally any Orange is the New Black character. They arcs, they make you someone you fucking hate, and they're like almost a cliche on paper. Pensatucky, she's a Bible bashing hick, and you're like, fuck her, she's the worst thing. And then three seasons later, she's your favorite fucking character in the whole show. And you're like, how did
it's
you
always
pull
been
this
red.
Off?
It'll always be red.
Yeah, red. And red even has an arc, even though she's kind of stoic. It's like her stoicness is like, it's so, the writing, the character work, although I haven't finished the later season, I'm not liking it that much because they're introducing new characters and get rid of the ones that I was so compelled by.
Yeah.
And so you have to kind of readjust. But my top five, I have Briny from Atonement as number five.
Yeah.
This is a tragic arc with it's tragic and hopeful at the same time. It pulls off this balancing act of being both a positive and a negative arc, which is really rare. And it's such, because that movie is just a complete character study and you don't realize it until the very last scene where you're like, oh fuck, that's what this movie was about. Number four is a tie. There's a show called Person of Interest and two characters, Root and Fusco. So Root is like a hacker. She's a villain. So both these characters are villains. Fusco is a corrupt cop who's basically like working for a main villain, but he's like the incompetent corrupt cop. And then he becomes one of the team. Both of these characters become part of the main team and they're like your favorite fucking characters. And they start as side villains and become compelling protagonists of the show. That show is one of the best for these really subtle serialized, because it's a case of the week. It's let's find the criminal kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the stealth serialized storytelling in that is mind blowing. But that's a Nolan brother writing that show. I reckon you'd love that show a lot. Number three is Dolores Van Cartier from Sister Act One. Sal's ear can be turned into a silk purse, as they say in the second one. It's such a great arc. And that's a really great dual arc too of the Mother Superior.
Yeah.
And they meet in the middle. They meet somewhere in the middle. And it's such a, I love that movie. That's what makes me.
They meet exactly in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. Number two is Julianne Potter from My Best Friend's Wedding. This is a tragic.
Yeah, okay.
This is an anti-hero tragic arc that's performed so compellingly and written so compellingly. the more I rewatch that movie, I'm like, oh fuck, it's like a magic. It's watching a magic trick. It feels like watching a magic trick because it shouldn't work. It's a rom com when none of the rom com things happen, so it shouldn't work. And then number one, bit of a controversial choice, and this was my favorite movie of all time. It's Lester Burnham from American Beauty.
Yeah.
I think it's the classic what he wants versus what he needs, and he's going after things so aggressively, and you're rooting for him to succeed, and then he kind of doesn't, and that's okay.
I'm very surprised that we didn't have any crossover.
Oh, really?
Really? Mm.
There's so much. When I was going through, I'm like, oh, fuck, all these are really good arcs.
Well, to be fair, I went really generic because I had very little time to prepare, but also because the big ones are the big ones for a reason.
Yeah, I tried to avoid some of the bigger ones because I knew I'd have time.
But I didn't, so.
So Zane, what's in your top five?
I wonder if we're going to have any crossover.
Maybe. I have two honorable mentions.
Cool.
Sarah Connor from the Terminator series.
Yep.
Because she, total change around. It's never inevitable where she ends up, but yeah. It is a huge change driven by the plot. Mm. So her arc is an incredibly compelling one because she is adapting to the environment around her. And then Tom Ripley from Talented Mr. Ripley.
I have yet to see this one. I've heard nothing but great things. Is that the one where it's like the gay plot going on in the middle of it, or is that the other one?
Yeah, there's definitely kind of like a will they, won't they sort of thing.
It's the one with Matt Damon, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Arguably Matt Damon's best performance.
Oh, really?
I really love Talented Mr. Ripley.
You didn't like him in We Bought a Zoo? Sorry.
I haven't prepared terrible. For these questions. Number five. Nelson Van Alden in Boardwalk Empire.
I have not watched this show.
What?
I know.
Go back and watch it.
But do I need to? I feel like I should watch, because this is the Sopranos creator, isn't it?
Yes.
I feel like I should watch the Sopranos first.
So Michael Van Alden.
Is that Steve Buscemi's character?
No. That's, I forget his name.
I only know Steve Buscemi in that show. or is it Steve Buscemi?
What's his name? The other Italian guy who's in everything. He's in Shall We Dance.
Okay, this is the actor from Shape of Water. This is the villain.
Michael Shannon?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Because he starts out as a super deeply, intensely religious agent for the Bureau of Internal Revenue, and he goes straight into mob enforcer.
Wow.
He loses his faith. He loses his family. It is an amazing kind of
fall I should give from this grace. Go. Okay.
Yes, the first two seasons are great. The third season started getting a bit choppy and got caught up in its own plot and fell into the incest trap that a lot of TV shows at that point did.
Like literal incest?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
One of the characters was...
Oh, because they're like, oh, it's on Game of Thrones and everyone loves it, so let's do that.
Yeah, it was around that time.
Really upsetting.
Like, what kind of love trauma could we give Chanster. This give this young guy character while his mother seduces him? Michael Corleone from Godfather 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Again, this is the movie.
Yeah.
This choice that he makes. And the same is my next one is Charles Foster Kane in Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
I need to revisit that one. The Other Side of the Wing came out, and so I'm going to try and do like an Orson Welles retrospective.
Yeah,
It's
really interesting. I really like movies that are kind of explanations. The plot is the explanation of the arc. So the movie is the arc, and the plot is where their arc has affected the world around them.
Yeah.
So I think that is Michael Corleone and Charles Foster Kane. And then Walter White, Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I figured this would be on your list. It wasn't because I haven't finished the show yet.
What?
I'm on season two because I found season two so uncompelling. And I've heard season
And you
two.
Haven't watched
I
it.
I haven't even started it.
It's on Stan. So. I'm getting there.
I don't think you are. It's been a decade.
There's so much to watch.
The six seasons. So it's been at least 5 years.
Jeez.
It's been a while, yeah.
Time is
relevant. Mm-hmm. And number one, no surprise. Any guesses?
Oh.
Oh, wait.
Is it just Earth Kid?
Eartha Kitt.
just Eartha Kitt in life.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
Kill Bill.
Yes. Yeah, the Bride from Kill Bill 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Not only from her transformation from like rookie, she goes through so many arcs from rookie to assassin, from assassin to fugitive, and then from fugitive to Avenger, and then from Avenger to mother.
Yeah.
It is so many different arcs are represented.
There's
in that
so many
movie.
Different arcs, and they're like kind of jumbled up, but yeah. It all works.
Yeah, yeah. And so one is used to explain the other, which is yeah. on the
it's
way
very
to
emblematic
another.
Of how Tarantino kind of Frankenstein's genres and references together in the way that only he can, in that all those different kinds of arcs from those different genres come in. You know, that rookie to assassin comes from like the British cop movies, which he's kind of rolling in there. Yeah. And then the you know, it's very compelling.
And it's also, it represents both the environment creating a person's arc, which is the rookie to assassin, assassin to Avenger. Betrayed.
Yeah.
And then you have her arc, which is the assassin to Avenger.
Affecting
the environment. And so it's just really interesting. That's my number one.
Oh, very cool. Chanster. Right.
I don't have any honorable mentions because I'm lazy. well, technically my number five is two people from the same movie, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, both nice. Freddie Benson and Lawrence Jameson. They both go through different arcs. But it's kind of like
it's definitely a sister act story.
Yeah.
Exactly. They end up exactly in the middle working together.
Yeah. And then at the very end, after everything happens, they immediately go back to it, which is a great gag that I love. I use the same gag at the
spoilers.
End of, I use the same gag at the end of L Plates, how like she's strong. But she's still the same person and she can't help it. My next one is Ethan Hunt from the Mission Impossible series.
Ugh.
As a series, the way Ethan changes from movie to movie.
He only really changed from 3.
No. Because the way he changes, you see him slowly turning insane. And by the fifth movie, there's the scene where Simon Pegg is like, he's just died. He's come back to life. And he's like, all right, let's drive. And he's driving. And Simon Pegg's character is just looking at him going, what the fuck? And it's that moment that people are realizing that he is just straight up gone insane. It's probably my only complaint about 6 is the fact that 5th honestly made me think that, holy shit, are people realizing that he's absolutely batshit insane? And they kind of just left it.
And that's the reason why I discount this theory, is because they haven't owned it in the movies.
Well, they totally were until 6. Up to 5, it was like, oh, he's slowly going insane. Like, he's just that obsessed with the job that even at the end of 6, when he's fallen in love, it's completely gone by the next movie, and he's married to a woman who's completely different, who ends up coming back. And anyway, yeah. Ethan Hunt.
Crazy person.
Yeah. My next one is also a series. My next two are both series long arcs. I'm only counting the first 3 in both of these, though. Ellen Ripley from Alien to Alien 3. Her arc.
Most people would only count the first 2.
Well, no, I include the 3rd one. She's a different person from the 2nd movie to the 3rd one. And she goes through a different arc there of self-sacrifice. And then the 4th movie happened. And Prometheus happened. You know what? I should include the Alien Queen. Alien Queen. She has a great arc. She's from Alien vs. Predator to fucking being a half thing in Alien Resurrection. My next one is Martin Riggs from the Lethal Weapon series. Once again, only the first 3, mainly because I've only seen 4th. I saw the 4th one first when I was a kid and I do not remember at all. I don't remember liking it, though. I think I fell asleep. I don't know.
This is the character that in the series was played by the guy who's really abusive, wasn't it?
Mel Gibson?
No, in the TV series, the white guy.
Oh, right. I haven't seen the TV series.
The white guy. The guy's like the white guy, total dick, and he got fired from the show and everything.
Oh, nice.
And replaced with Sean William Scott.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's an interesting choice. I kind of want to go and watch the series.
He looks very
now.
Like the series guy, but apparently the series guy is a very diva dickhead.
But either way, this is mainly really the first movie because I really love Martin Riggs' arc in the first movie, but in the second movie is also good, and the third movie, yeah, sure, whatever. The main reason I want to bring up Lethal Weapon is because I just love the fact that the second movie, the whole plot of the second movie, which is about the apartheid, is because Murtog has a, in the first movie, Murtog has a little sticker on his fridge that says end apartheid, and people were like writing in going, oh, Richard Donner, how could you do this? You know, it's not your business and whatever. So he was like, okay, let's make the next movie about the apartheid. Fuck you guys. Get even more hate. And my number one pick is Gloria from Colossal.
Nice.
Yeah.
I honestly only realized it.
That's good. Yeah.
Recently, like anything, but yeah, her arc. Honestly,
that's another one of those movies I can totally imagine you making.
Yeah. Well, it was when I was talking about L Plates and Pizza and the arcs there. I was like, oh, wait, yeah, Colossal. That's exactly what I go for. So, yeah, I just fucking love that movie. It's so good.
Well, that's it for this episode on character arcs. If you have some favorite character arcs, you can contact us on social media or on we're on Instagram and Twitter at PictureRangers, and you can email us if you have a top five list. We can start reading them out online, on air. I mean, not online.
On air we are online, so you know, either one would have been completely
at
fine.
MotionPictureRangers@gmail.com, and you can find me on Twitter at ShaneM_Anderson, and I'm on Letterboxd at 224 frames.
You can find me on Instagram at TheChanster, and I don't have to plug Red Curtain Hill because we already did it earlier.
And Zane C. Weber on all socials.
At Zane C. Weber.
At Zane C. Weber.
On all the socials and thatsnotkindofproductions.com for everything that I do.
Including some really great podcasts, and we've got some new ones. There's a video game one coming out. There's the fabulous Disneyverse Disney Debates, the unofficial definitive Disney debate podcast.
Oh, yeah, we make a lot of defining statements about Disney.
This is true. So thank you guys all for listening, and we'll speak to you again next week. Bye.
Bye.
Fork, hello.
Fork, hi.
You know what you need to be doing? You need to be listening to the Floof and Popper podcast.
I'm Mel.
I'm Taylor. And we're going to talk about all things dogs.
Dog stories. Dog breeds.
Dog tips and tricks.
Dog puns.
Dog jokes.
Dog everything.
Out if you're not listening. Hit us up at the Floof and Popper podcast wherever you get your podcast.
Tune in.
That's Not Kind of Productions podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.